Mark My Words shares Mark Homer's contrarian views on investing, business, finance, economics, and all things money. Mark interviews the world's most successful business, finance, and money experts, as well as imparting his knowledge in a factual, direct, and no-nonsense manner. Welcome to Mark My Words. And here is your host, Mark Homer.
And welcome to the first official episode of PPTV. It's a very special one today. First of all, you've got me, your social media extraordinaire, and Mark and Rob, who you both know very well from Progressive and Unlimited Success. Now, today's a super special episode. It is our 11th year anniversary, and we are here in HQ, where you are now after 11 years. Started in your living room?
You've
told us many times. So what we're going to do today, well, I'll run through and you'll go in a bit more detail about the 11 things that you've learned.
Okay.
Sound good?
Yeah, go for it. Yep.
Okay, so the first one, Mark, you say you should always hold property and never sell.
Yeah, so obviously this is driven by yield and the amount of income that the property produces. So as long as it's a good yielding property and it's not causing too many problems and, you know, there's not sort of a general issue with the property, and that shouldn't be the case as long as you've bought well, then there's not really much reason to ever get rid of it. You generally find that you'll come back to it in 10 years, it'll have gone up significantly, clearly. Probably not the thing to focus on, but even more important than that, you will be able to take income from it, probably for the rest of your life. And I know with properties that we've sold, as I drive past them and walk past them later on after the event, kind of feel a bit regretful.
Yep. Yeah. Wish you hadn't sold them up.
Wish I hadn't sold. Usually, you know, if you need the money, you can get a bank to sort of raise a little bit more money on them anyway. You know, inflation obviously pushes the rents up over time, and there's other things pushing the rents up even more at the moment. Clearly, the government have increased taxation and
just
some other things, which means that there are less landlords about, and less rental properties about. So therefore, rents have gone up and are going up. But in addition to that, obviously, over time, prices increase, and therefore the value and the rents go up, and your debt should go down.
Having our 11th birthday, we've pretty much gone through pretty much a full cycle.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we started together, we didn't have experience of the cycle. So when you've seen it and you can look back, because I remember actually being in the dining room, living room of my house with Mark, when prices start to drop, and Mark was probably like, whoa, you know, maybe they won't go up, maybe they won't double every 10 years like everyone says, and they did. And it's just like that, for as long as we've been doing it, they seem to. So yeah, hindsight is a wonderful thing, and we've got a little bit of it now. Now we've got grey bits. Anyway, shall I do the next one?
Yes, yeah. Okay, so the next one is, you have a model for sustained success.
Yeah, in property, yeah.
Yeah, the VOFM.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people get distracted, overwhelmed, confused, spin too many plates, you know, start stuff, stop it, start, stop, start, stop, start, stop. And actually, there are four things if you do in property, specifically, but consistently, and they're easy, you will get successful. And they are simply, one, maintaining the number of viewings. You know, people get really excited, do loads of viewings, a few weeks later, the viewings drop. Oh, there's no properties on the market, or they get distracted. You've got to keep the viewings up. Mark still views to this day, and some, you know, he'd view anything he could. You've got to view even when you're not necessarily in the market for buying, because you've got to show the agents that you're still in the market. Sometimes got to view stuff you don't necessarily want, because you want anything if it's the right price. So, you know,
it's building a pipeline.
Well, exactly.
It?
And it's getting out there and getting seen and getting known. And yeah, deals will come to you in 6 months. Mark will tell you sometimes he's had deals that have come to him 2 years later.
Really?
Yeah. So
the greed deals that have taken 2 years to complete.
Yeah. So you've got to keep the if anyone's watching, you'll know if you're making good progress, because you know you're doing a lot of viewings, and you'll know if it's started to slow. So get your viewings up. Yeah. The next thing, O, is offers. There's loads of people who go out there and view 30 properties and don't offer any. Because, you know, well, I've got to get the perfect price, I've got to get all the money out, I've got to get 30% BMV. You've got to put a decent amount of offers in, and it kind of sounds like common sense. But if you don't want the deal, put a low offer, because any property works at the right price. And make sure you, on a percentage of your viewings, maybe 25% or something like that, you put offers forward. If you haven't yet got the finance, you still put offers forward, because you could put an offer forward and it gets declined. Or it gets accepted, but it can still take months to get the property. Third thing, which is finance. So the F is finance. If you haven't got access to finance, you don't do the viewings and don't do the offers because you don't feel like you've got access to finance. So getting your credit, good. You know, getting access to loans, you know, whether that's, you know, you got on your Barclays app, where you can just click and get your 25 or 35 grand loan, you know, getting JV partners, private investors, you know, Mark, through him and his family, you know, we raised money in the early years, having good bridging contacts, having good commercial bank contacts, being liquid. And then the final thing, which is the boring bit, which has to be done, is M, which is management. You can buy good deals, but if you don't vet tenants properly, you don't get properly inventoried, do good tenant checking, look after the tenants, look after the property, or if you're doing, say, service accommodation, you know, manage that well as a business, then what started well will start to decay.
So the next one, Mark, don't pay trades until work is complete.
Yeah, so...
you have experience there, I'm guessing. Well,
mate, your main man will probably be watching.
Yeah, oh God, he'll ask for commission after this. Yeah. So sort of over the last 10 years, 11 years, clearly we've done hundreds and hundreds of refurbs, developments, you know, building stuff, all sorts of stuff. And a key sort of thing that keeps coming up is, especially now, trades are very busy. There's lots of work for them. There probably aren't enough trades. Lots of them went in the recession, and they went off into other sort of, you know, industries and businesses. So there are probably less of them, and there's quite a lot of work. So increasingly, they're just picking and choosing their jobs, and they sort of dart between each one. Not all of them, but lots of them do. So what I find is generally the way to get them to finish a job is to only pay for works complete, and there'll be some of them will, you know, really, really, you know, put the pressure on to get all the money paid up before they've finished, and often they'll be trying to get ahead all the way through the job. The more ahead they are, the less likely many of them are to get your job completed in good time.
Okay.
And especially towards the end of the project, if you've paid everything, lots of them will sort of just get onto the next job and not come back.
Depending on,
you know, whether, if you've got more jobs for them and what sort of relationship you've got. They're not all like that, but that is a common theme through the industry. And obviously that's then done to them and their subcontractors behaving the same way. So often, you know, it's something that just sort of goes around.
Our next one then is no money down is possible.
Back in, we met Mark end of 05, start of 06. And within about 3 months of knowing each other, we started buying properties together. And I didn't have any funds. And, you know, Mark didn't let me know how much funds he had, but he had funds available. And actually probably had funds he didn't know were available all over the place in businesses he had and shares that he could sell and things like that. And I would never have been able to start and get into property and get out of debt if you needed deposits. And, you know, the discussion of no money down or other people's money or can you do get into property without your own money is highly debated and topical. On the one hand, people say, well, yeah, you can look at people like me and, you know, you just do JVs and you borrow money with private loans or you go to, you know, bridges or however you get the money. And other people, I say, well, there's nothing strictly no money down. I just want to let everyone know that the quickest way to scale your portfolio is by using other people's money.
I think a lot of new starters, when they come to Progressive as well, their minds are almost blown when they hear it doesn't need to be their own money.
Yeah.
When they hear about...
Because you don't know what you don't know.
No, exactly. Mm. So moving on then. So economic disasters, cycles, which you spoke about a little bit as well, are usually solvable or even good.
I think they are. I mean, crunch 08, 09, 10. Now we're going through some other headwinds like Brexit, you've seen sterling depreciate quite a lot. And because of that, inflation's gone up. So the cost of goods and services is rising. So the value of your pound in your pocket is reducing. And all that stuff... initially looks like it's going to be a big issue, and you know, newspapers will put headlines up like, oh well, you know, the attacks on buy to let, taxation's increasing, you know, you've got new sort of PRA rules, which means that you need much bigger deposits and you can't borrow as much on a buy to let mortgage, so it's making it much more difficult. What they don't say is, well, rents are rising because of that, because there are less landlords in the market. As cost prices are increasing in terms of refurbs and in terms of men working on the properties, that just means that new build cost prices are increasing. It creates an added sort of push on the value of existing properties. So you've got all these new build properties being built, I don't know, might be help to buy or shared ownership or whatever. If they were costing, I don't know, £90 a foot to build sort of 09, 10 when things were cheap, and now they're more like £110, £120 a foot, well, they look relatively expensive when they're sold onto a first-time buyer in comparison to an existing property. Mm-hmm. So that then drags up the prices of existing properties. Lots of people say, well, you know, house prices are out of control. A lot of the properties we buy in this area or you know, have in the portfolio, the value of that property is actually no more than the cost of rebuilding it. Therefore, the land value is nil or negative. Mm-hmm. So it could be argued that the increases in the value of the property over the last 2 or 3 years have largely just been driven by the increase in the cost of labour and materials.
Move through the strategies, cut your teeth, scale up progressively.
There's commercial conversions, there's rent-to-rent, there's deal packaging, there's these all sorts of different types of option agreements. There's, did I say serviced accommodation? There's obviously single lets, there's standard HMOs, there's, you know, like flat lets, there's mini motors, there's so many property strategies. And I think that it's very easy to get excited and go for the big glory one. And I've seen quite a lot of people in the progressive community, not really with much experience, talking about 10, 15, 20,000 square foot buildings for millions of pounds. And people always ask me, where should I start and what strategy should I use? And it's wise to build yourself up by starting with a couple of single lets to get your fundamental knowledge of buying a house, the, you know, the conveyancing process, the rental process, dealing with a letting agent. Because it's easier dealing with one letting agent with one tenant than it is three letting agencies where you've got 24 tenants in three HMOs. And then once you feel comfortable and confident in that, then you get your first HMO and you might do a 6 or even an 8 bed. Once you've done a couple of them, or you need you haven't got deposits, you might do rent to rents and start with that, which is fairly low barriers to get into that strategy. You know, like Mark bought a lot of single lets before we even did any HMOs. And then we tested a few HMOs before we really scaled it. And our first commercial property that we bought was actually, it was one of these four buildings we're in. It was our office. I think it was over there. Yeah. And, you know, Mark bought it very cheap, but also we moved Progressive Property into it. Mm-hmm. So it's very low risk getting into commercial. We'd not done commercial before. So having a company with good accounts, so I had a decent lease, and moving into it and renting it to ourselves meant we had a guaranteed tenant, which meant we'd solved a problem, and we got it, paid £290 for it or something.
We did, it was £290.
And it's worth a lot more now. I mean, that was cheap. In fact, the next door one, when we bought that one to knock it through for the training suite, you had to pay a lot more than that, didn't you?
Yeah.
£400
yeah,
for
that was £390.
Yeah, and you didn't like paying £390 for it, did you? Because he paid, but you know, it showed how well he bought it, that the one next door we had to pay, what was that, 35% more. When we converted the office into the training suite. This was the old training suite and we moved it back over here. So the point is, we didn't jump into commercial and try and HMO the cathedral or something like that, you know, and do a big project. And Mark's projects have got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, but progressively and slowly bigger and bigger.
Dinner party investments, not as good as ugly ones, yield focus, not bragging rights.
So lots
that's
of
such like a mark, isn't that?
Yeah.
So lots of people love to sort of buy properties and then go and tell other people about what they bought, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But I generally say that the category of investors that make the least in this space are usually ones that go out and buy stuff because it looks good and because less sophisticated sort of investors or people who haven't invested before are impressed because they bought a nice shiny sort of house or brand new flat or whatever, and because it says in the Daily Mail or, you know, some other newspaper that this is the latest investment and that's the hot spot and all this sort of stuff. Often it's not the case. Generally speaking, and this is a generalization, the uglier the rental property in sort of, you know, a couple of steps up just from the Bronx is the best stuff to buy from a yield perspective. That's the amount of income that it generates as you know, as a percentage of its value. I think it's very important to focus on that and focus on the money. And the money will give you sort of bragging rights if that's what you need. I've seen that so many times. People will go out and buy a big 5-bed house along a really nice street and rent it out to a nice family. And they'll end up with a 3% yield, whereas they could have gone and bought 10 small single lets and got a 7% yield. The debt that they borrow, you know, managed to borrow on the £1 million house, five bed, might be 400,000 because that's the biggest amount of money that that rent will support, because the bank will work out, well, what's the monthly mortgage payment going to be? How much rent do we need to support that? Well, the rent's only this, so therefore you can only borrow 400,000. Whereas if you go and buy smaller, much higher yielding properties, well, you know, they can support a much greater mortgage. So on those, you may borrow 750,000. So
and I guess as well, you're not tying it all into one property then.
So you have more, it reduces the risk for sure. So you're putting 250,000 in the 10 small single lets versus 600,000 into the big one.
Five bed.
Yeah, and after all the costs, the 10 single lets will generate a bigger income. Mm-hmm. Capital growth, well, you know, it may be about the same. I don't buy into the notion that small, lower-end properties in cheaper areas go up less than nicer, bigger properties in more expensive areas. I think that is just a misconception and a fallacy. But I hear it all the time. Oh, there's more. You will always get more capital growth in the nice areas. And it's just bunkum. It's absolute bunkum, because if you look over, it may be the case that at the start of the cycle, or you know, at a given point in time, that the nicer area is rising, mm-hmm. and after a recession, that they're typically the better areas are the ones that rise the quickest. But what you'll find is that at a different point in the cycle, the lower end area will be rising more than the nicer area, a little bit like now. So you had 2010, you know, the epicenter of UK property would be Mayfair. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where all the growth started, and you had Mayfair, you know, Knightsbridge, Kensington, Chelsea, all the best areas, and they rose very strongly from 2010 onwards after the recession. And you saw areas of the north or Scotland even still going backwards. And of course, all I heard for many years was, your property in London is always going to go up more than your properties in the north, or you know, properties in the Midlands. And that was true at the time, but people have short memories. You know, we're now into a phase where those areas have actually fallen a bit, because stamp duty's gone up, and because of, you know, the uncertainty around Brexit. But I think more so what the commentators don't mention is that those areas have had such a good run, and they're so much, they're like at the front of the roller coaster, and they've gone up to the top, and they're coming down, whereas you've still got the sort of north of England and maybe definitely Scotland and the Midlands, which might be a bit, that's still going up to the top of the sort of hump on the roller coaster track. So, you know, you're seeing certainly outside of London, that is where most development funders are happier to lend now. Lots of the investors within London won't buy within London. They want to buy outside the M25 in areas like the Midlands, or you know, some areas of the north of England, commuter land. So I think it's important to understand that.
Yeah.
And it's important to probably buy in those areas when they're feeling a bit unloved and people have turned against them, because there might have been a great run in London for a period of time. But just remember that, you know, people and the economy and the environment is fickle, mm-hmm. That soon changes. Capital growth, you can't predict sort of exactly when it's going to take place and how much, but over the long run, you can have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen.
Mentors, experienced investors will be the greatest assets.
Yeah, I think that we're kind of taught in England to work hard, mm-hmm. and it's almost like culturally wrong to ask for help. And I think that at Progressive, we champion the community and reaching out to people who've been there before, people who've blazed the trail. You know, like Mark was sort of an accidental mentor of mine. When I met him, it wasn't like a plan. He was going to be my mentor and all that kind of thing. But he was far ahead of me. But we were a similar age and we had similar interests. But he was sort of a mentor of mine in that He'd got a lot more property and more experience in business, and the company that he helped me get a job in, the first property company we worked for before Progressive, he'd worked there for a year, so he knew all the, he knew what the boss was going to be like. He knew if the boss had had his coffee, he'd be approachable, and if he hadn't, he wouldn't. And he knew he'd be trying to get me to finish early on a Friday to go down the Draper's Arms, and he knew he'd wanted to take us out and get us drunk on, you know, Friday and Saturday night. And he protected me and taught me.
Yeah.
He taught me about all the overseas stuff that he didn't think was working as well as the existing older stuff. And since then, Mark and I have really been sold on the concept of meeting people who are further ahead than you, mm-hmm. trying to get a lunch with them. If they've got mentorship services, pay for them. Try and have a call with them once a month. Present your challenges to them and ask them what their experience is. Mark's very good at getting information out of people who've been there before to help him build his knowledge and a better strategy. You know, like, why make the mistakes yourself? People say, don't they, it's good to, you know, make mistakes as long as you don't repeat them. But actually, I think it's not good to make mistakes. It's better to watch someone else make all the mistakes and learn vicariously through those. And Mark sometimes uses me as a guide to go and chuck out there and test all these things and see if it works out. And we like to test things first, or work with people who've already done it.
Obviously, you also say we actually do have a lot of content available to people as well. We have books, podcasts, YouTube videos like this, which people can access. They don't have to pay for the advice.
Well, a smart thing to do is to consume all of our free information first and get relentless on it. Listen to all of our podcast episodes. Mark runs a podcast, mark my words. I run The Disruptive Entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. We have the Progressive Property Podcast. We have all the Mark's books, my books, the property books. We have a YouTube channel with hundreds of videos. We have the community. And spend a week just gobbling it all up, because you'll actually get 80% of your questions answered, you'll get a lot more clear. Then you'll know which strategies are right for you, and then you can pick the right courses for you, rather than, you know, doing all of them and getting really overwhelmed. Now, that might cost me some money to say that, because obviously we'd like you to do all of our courses. But yeah, we put a lot of free information out there so that people can try us before they invest a lot of money, so that they can connect with us, and just to give you more clarity.
Focusing on 1 to 3 strategies and get great, test new things for 6 to 12 months first.
I think if you have loads and loads of strategies that you're trying to engage in and make work and learn at the same time, you can become a busy fool very quickly, and you don't really get good at any of them in any sort of reasonable space of time. So I think it's good just to focus on maybe 2 or 3 strategies. You know, Rob likes to talk about the 70-20-10, where you spend 70% of your time on a main strategy, 20 on another, 10% on another that you've just sort of got one eye on. And I think that's a good way to look at it. I see people get into a new year and often become sort of, you know, their eyeballs are going around looking at all this different stuff, trying a bit of this, dabbling in that, dabbling in this, doing a bit of this, and they find it very hard to spend enough time to go really deep and become very, very good at a strategy. And of course, it takes that to be able to compete with the others who are in that marketplace.
Not just testing it and going, it didn't work.
Yeah.
You don't plant a seed and expect the tree the next day.
Yeah.
We're in the instant gratification world where everyone expects everything really quick. Mm-hmm. So the people who continue to do things consistently well for a long period of time, they're separated at rising to the top at the moment. Mark's taught me that a lot, because I get really excited and want to start everything new. And I think it's probably fair to say I've encouraged Mark to get into a few things which have been good for us. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very fair to say he stopped us doing plenty of things that I would have got us into, which would have distracted us. So I think it's also good to have partners and good counsel around you who are different as well, who can just keep you in check and just make sure you check. Now, one thing I think you always want to say is, if you're going to look at something new, have I given what I'm doing long enough? Really, have I given what I'm doing long enough to actually work? And normally the answer is no.
Capital income balance, short term and long term.
Yeah, so if you're all capital based, capital is a lump of stored money. So, you know, you buy a commercial conversion, there's a lot of capital in there, i.e. future profit. So a lot of people are doing commercial conversions or big developments thinking that they're making 2.1 million, but they won't get that for 3 years. And what are they making in the meantime? Nothing. In fact, they've got debt running on trying to get that 2.1 whatever million. So yeah, you want to make big capital lumps. You know, we've got capital tied into these properties, etc. But you also need to balance that with income, paying your mortgage, paying your school fees, everything else. So things like deal packaging and rent to rents. And for Mark and I, our training companies and our books and information materials, they are an income stream. You know, our books don't have a capital value. I couldn't say to someone, hey, buy the IP of my book for 10 million quid. No one's going to do that. But it's got an income value, i.e., you know, we make a net a quid, woohoo, per book. We share it 50-50, but after the tax and everyone else. So we make about 12 pence a book, you and I. We do sell a good, you know, we sell tens, maybe even up to 100,000 a year in books. So it's decent, but it doesn't have any capital value. But we're doing this 85,000 square foot building that is a millions of pounds worth of profit. But what, Mark, that's going to take 2 or 3 years to finish?
Yeah.
So he thinks fine. So it's wise to have a balance of both. And of course, capital is more long term and income is more short term. So yes, but often people are all one or the other. And normally, they're not much cash flow.
Number 11, and that's funds do not produce the returns you will. You can get double digit to infinite.
Yeah, so lots of people, when they're looking to make an investment or go and see an IFA or a financial planner, to get clear on what it is they want to do, the IFA or the financial planner may look at their spread of investments currently, they'll probably look at their income streams, they'll probably look at their age and work out what their objectives are and create a sort of portfolio that meets those objectives in terms of risk, in terms of income, and making sure they've got enough money in later life so they don't take too many risks and put capital at risk, you know, which they won't have later on. I think that's fine, but what tends to happen is they'll sit with an IFA and the IFA will say, well, yeah, I mean, you know, you need some property and you could have some sort of UK-based equities and you could have some equities in, I don't know, the Far East or wherever else. Maybe we'll get you some government bonds and some gilts and all this sort of stuff. And people, and often the IFA financial planners sort of associate the property investment within the fund, because that isn't necessarily the bit that's explained, is the same thing as direct investment into property, which you would operate yourself, and it could be residential or commercial. But the reality is, if you invest directly, just in a little buy-to-let or a HMO, typically your return on capital invested, that's the return you get, you know, on a leveraged investment, i.e. on a property that you buy with a mortgage, it will easily be 15, 20, 25% if you take the capital and the income into account over the long term. That's a property that just yields at 6 or 7%, because in a very simplistic way, if you bought a 100 grand property and you put a £25,000 deposit into it, and every year, let's just say that generates, I don't know, £5,000, you've got a really nice return there of £5,000 off an investment of £25,000, not an investment of £100,000, because you've leveraged it, you've borrowed money. Then in addition, if it goes up 5% annually, goes up £5,000 every year, well, that's a return on the £25,000 that you put in, rather than the £100,000 that it costs for the property. So you're making a £10,000 return overall against a 25%, against a £25,000 investment.
I learned 11 years ago that you should learn to manage your money and you should manage your own investments. No one cares about your money more than you. And the better you get at managing your money, the more you will make. And this is not against anyone else who might manage your money. It's not a judgment call. But we'll all manage our own money better than better than anyone else. Just like you'd look after your own child, maybe better than a babysitter would, because it's your money. And you get infinite return on learning how to manage your money well. Because the better you learn how to manage your money, the more money you make investing your money. So it's a return on the knowledge as well as a return on the money.
Brilliant, what a one to end on. That's fantastic.
So I don't know if everyone who's watching knows where the Progressive Property TV is. So what's the channel called? Is our channel called Progressive Property?
Yes.
Yeah, so you can find that on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be doing a lot more of these kind of interviews on the PPTV channel?
Yeah, there should be at least one a week moving forward.
Okay, great. And also I recommend that people listen to the Progressive Property podcast. So then you've got us on video when you've got time to sit down, have a coffee, and you've got us when you're in the car and on the train as well.
Fantastic.
So thanks, Beth.
That's right. Thank you for joining me, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for watching, guys. If you did like this video, give it a like below, and why not come check out our YouTube channel as well to see more videos like this.